Our next chapter is chapter number 11, Hardy's views on religion. Hardy is sceptic by persuasion. He does not believe in a god but seems to admit the existence of a force sometimes called will, more often merely life, which is neither god nor evil, neither benevolent nor malevolent, and utterly indifferent to the feelings of man. He does not accept the view that life is governed by two conscious and opposing forces, God and evil. Hardy has no belief in spiritual compensation or the possibility of perfect happiness in another world. He does not believe in providence pitying the hard lot of poor Tess. He asks in irony, where was Tess' guardian angel? Where was providence of her simple faith? Perhaps he was talking or was pursuing one. He was in a journey or he was asleep and not to be awakened. Inverted comma closed. He has no sympathy with traditional Christianity or its theology or its form of worship. He cannot bring himself to take a geocentric view of things, a zenithal paradise and a nadiral hell. As foreign to Hardy are the dreams of people on other planet. He cannot accept the doctrine of various punishment. Commenting on the fate of Tess, Hardy says that divines may be content to see retribution in the fate of Tess for the sins of her male ancestor, but though to visit the sins of the father may be morally good enough for the divinities, it is scorned by average human nature and it is therefore does not mend the matter. Hardy's rationalistic mind cannot tolerate mysticism, which forms such a large part of religion. The popular Christian conception of chastity is based upon the mystic idea of purity of blood and soul, necessary of union with Christ, the divine bridegroom. Hardy sees no foundation for such purity in nature. Hardy pities Tess for her mental suffering due to the fear lest her wedding gown should betray her by changing color, as a mystic robe of Queen Genevieve had betrayed her. Similarly, he pities the agony of Tess due to the superstition about hell and its tortures for the unbaptized child, and he condemns the practice of telling young people in Christian countries of the quiescent and curious details of torment in hell. Hardy has little sympathy with church attendance and delivers a bitter attack on church goers. Sunday is the day of vanity, when flesh goes forth to coquet with flesh, while hypocritically affecting business with spiritual things. Nature is greater than theology. What woman asks Hardy in test of the Uber Willis, among the most faithful adherents of the truth, believes the promises and threats of the world in the sense in which she believes in her own children, or would not throw her theology to the wind is weighed against their happiness. Hardy noticed the religion teaches men to make the curiously unnatural sacrifice of humanity to mysticism. Miss Mercy chant is the typical of woman brought upon strictly Christian ideals, but such is her view of life that events which produced heartache is in other wrote beatific smiles upon her. Hardy does not believe in the sincerity of modern churchmen as regards the faith they profess. He regards modern theological training for the church as a 10-year endeavor to graft technical belief on the actual scepticism. He admits the real faith has a sublimating power. It can apotheosize the ordinary man and woman and make man forget the ugly reality in the vision of the higher things. But Hardy does not want a sedative to forget the ugly real world. He wants to see life up unwrapped, uncontrolled, untrammeled by those creeds which futilely attempt to check what wisdom would be content to regulate. His favors the pagan idea which seems life as it is without troubling about the unseen world. Some of the restful and the consolatory hymns of the Christianity are at the bottom pagan and pantheistic. The Christian Benedictine is a pantheistic utterance in the monotheistic falsity. He thinks one could feel that a saner religion had never prevailed under the sun. Agnosticism he apparently welcomes, for it is not a return to sun worship, it is a blow stuck at theolatry. But Hardy is hardly logical in making God, or rather the goods who do not exist, responsible for the misgovernment of the world. In The Mayor of Casterbridge, he speaks of the ingenious machinery contrived by the gods of reducing human possibilities of amelioration to a minimum, which arranges that wisdom to do shall come peri passu with the departure of Jews for doing. Again, at the conclusion of the story of Tess, he remarks, justice was done, and the president of the immortals, in the Aeschylean phrase, had ended his sport with Tess. In his second preface to the novel, he defends himself against criticism of this remark by quoting the authority of Shakespeare, who makes Gloucester cry in Crying Lear, "As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods, they kill us for their sport." But Hardy forgets that Shakespeare expresses the evoked sentiment in a strictly dramatic fashion by putting it in the mouth of a certain type of character, whereas Hardy makes his own comment on the whole history of life of Tess. An apologist of Hardy, Mr. Harold Child, has tried to explain him as follows. "Few with doubt the profound injustice of the social justice which murdered Tess after perverting her, but the president of the immortals and his sport do not seem to belong to Hardy's conceptions of the government of the world. Now where else do we find him suggesting that the immanent will take any pleasure in the sorrows of mankind, or feels any jealousy of their joy? We are to understand that it is death to the frogs without being sport to the boys. But perhaps the cries of the Gloucester in King Lear, as flies to wanton boys are we to the gods, they kill us for their sport, chimed in with Hardy's just anger at the tensed and ruin of Tess. And he, so to speak, shook his first at the unheeding power. The phrase certainly differs in tone from the slow, remorseless building with which the story moves on. It slipped out, and yet one cannot wish it away. It is not philosophically consonant with the novel as a whole. It gives the reader's feelings a thrill or sympathetic relief.